Finally, as the UK prepares for a general election on the 7th of May, one of the British Labour Party's leading intellectuals is warning that Labour must deal with the challenge of immigration and multiculturalism. Maurice Glassman is a member of the House of Lords and director of the Faith and Citizenship Program at London Metropolitan University. He's championed the idea of a strong civil society that challenges the rampant free market and also the powerful state. Lord Glassman's allies have traditionally been faith and ethnic communities, but he knows there's deep disquiet in Britain about immigration, and that's led to the rise of the UK Independence Party, or UKIP. So will immigration be a decisive and divisive issue in the general election?
Yes, huge. I mean, it comes in number one. You know, if you ask people what their concerns are, it's that. So there's been unprecedentedly high levels of immigration. Now there's real palpable issues about what's our common life, what's our common values, but it's also about wages, schools. So immigration is a hugely, but what they keep on getting told is there's nothing you can do because we're members of the European Union, signed up to this free movement. So there is then, well, why are we part of that? So that's the emergence of UKIP as a force, which is polling at around 14-15%.
Yeah. And you feel that the UK Independence Party is as much a threat to Labour as it is to the Tories?
It is. And so England's also a divided country. There's North and South. It's a very big difference. And in the South, it overwhelmingly takes a huge amount of Labour voters, but is overwhelmingly Tory voters who are disaffected with what they see as an essentially liberal Conservative Party signed up. But in the North of England, UKIP is really getting support overwhelmingly from Labour voters. And their slogan is, we want our country back. So you can see the possibilities in that. They're saying that the country belongs to the people and it doesn't belong to capital and to a global ruling class.
On that question of UKIP, mm-hmm. What is the answer? Is the answer for Labour, is it what, to go back to a more, how do we put it, selective or restricted or restrained immigration policy?
The answer, first of all, is not to demonise the UKIP voters. I've been to former mining villages that are voting UKIP. So it's to recognise, first of all, that there's an estrangement from the, let's say, the ancestors of the people who created the party. There's a feeling of dispossession, that the party's been taken away, that it's very middle class, that our concerns are not their concerns. So there's a sense of loss. That's the first thing. So there has to be a concerted respect for UKIP voters, you know, a conversation with them. And what we've found is that then there's issues about the control of assets that are very strong for Labour, that there's too much concentration of control in too few hands, and then decentralisation of power to people. But moving on certainly is to find allies in Europe to renegotiate this free movement. That's very important. So it's to understand that these are fundamental issues of political economy. They're not about bigotry. And England's a very open country. People just wanted it to have a political discussion about how we build a common life with the people who are there. And that was proving difficult. It's absolutely vital that people are able to name their pain, to say that this is causing me grief. That's politics. And then to try to start building coalitions with other people to change it.
It gets tricky though, Maurice, because the other area where you got into trouble with, if you like, the intellectual elites, the liberal elites, was where you suggested at least communicating with the supporters of the English Defence League, which is we're not talking about you sitting down with the skinheads, but I think you did at least want to understand what is the grievance behind this.
Well, where there's anger and where there's rage, you know, this is about anti-fascist organising and goes back to the 20s. There were two strategies. One was to demonise them. But what that does is that just increases the polarisation and increases their power. Or the other strategy is to divide them, is to talk to them and try to build relationships and work out what's going on. So that was a really horrible organisation. But I was just saying, as a matter of strategy, our first move mustn't be hatred and demonisation of people, but to try to engage and see if you can sort of engage their energy and their rage in more constructive ways, which has to be a common good. So we're always trying to bring immigrants together with locals and see where that conversation goes. And it always goes in the same direction, to let you know. well, why don't we get together and try and sort out wages? This should be home territory for Labour, issues relating to housing. And then accountability. What people feel is they feel powerless. So people feel that they're just not heard. So the vital thing always is, you know, Saul Alinsky, who I love, the community organiser, said that the definition of a liberal was someone who walked out the room before the argument began. You know, and the real challenge to everybody is stay in the room, hear what's going on. There's no saying it's going to work out, and often it doesn't. But when it does, it's magic. And when you get a genuine coalition going on between religious and secular, locals and immigrants, that's the common good. So the common good is difficult. That's what I understand, and my life is, I think, a testament to that.
Well, it is, and it, I mean, your family were immigrants to the UK, Jewish immigrants to the UK. Let me ask you very directly, though, Maurice, is Britain now multicultural enough that it's got where it should be?
Well, it's a dynamic story. So what I say is we haven't put enough emphasis on bringing people together. So there was a sort of official ideology of a sort of multiculturalism, which didn't stress bringing people together and working together to change their world. Democracy, it wasn't democratic enough. So what is required is a real renewal of democracy. Democracy in local places, democracy in relating to economic power. What you find is particularly poor people, immigrants and locals, have a shared dispossession in many ways. But there's very few places anymore where they can get together and work out a common life. And then once they start engaging in doing things together, relationship and friendships form. And that's the vital thing, is we have to move from a legalistic conception of our association to a genuine idea of democratic association, which involves developing leaders from groups, immigrants and local groups, that are not represented at the moment in politics.
You do make the point that pluralism and diversity can undermine the solidarity that's necessary for redistribution and the welfare state. Why is that?
Well, if people don't feel that they share a fate with other people, so the building up of welfare and solidarity is a political achievement, but we tended to start thinking of it as a set of legal entitlements. And that's just a mistake. It was a political, that was the achievement of the labour movement, that we would insure each other against destitution, we would insure each other in terms of health and in terms of providing a mutual home in the world. Now, that's an enormous imaginative leap to feel responsible and to share a fate and turn that fate into a shared destiny. Now, if you feel that you don't share the life of others, then what you will get is a lack of support for the sacrifices required to do that. So the welfare state, which used to be a source of unity, has become a site of contestation. And people feel that people are getting out who aren't putting in. And so there has to be a renewal of solidarity. So pluralism and diversity are absolutely necessary, but so are the common life and the common good. And that's the paradox. You need both. And we kind of lost the sight of the other side.
This is the great misunderstanding about the rise of the so-called nationalist parties in Europe. People automatically associate them. Certainly, many do have a very xenophobic tinge to them. But they're not parties classically of the free market right. Their reaction is against what? The threat to those social democracies and those welfare states that they feel are threatened by immigration.
Oh, certainly. So, I mean, there's lots of rivers that run through them. But for all Labour parties or social democratic parties throughout Europe, there's a tendency to retreat into quite an elitist position and to have, again, contempt for people who are trying to express concerns. These are, once again, Labour voters who feel estranged and that their interests aren't being represented. So there's a desire to re-establish a relationship of trust with working people. I mean, it shouldn't really be hostile territory for Labour parties, I think.
You worked, you know, hand in glove with faith leaders, including the leaders of mosques all across Britain. Is there, though, a particular issue with some sections of the Islamic community in the UK?
Oh, well, there's no doubt about that. You know, there are issues relating to violence. That's one area, and issues relating to a common good and whether that's possible. So, you know, this is a story that's unfolding, and it's what's absolutely necessary is that by all means possible, we need to engage with Muslims and with Muslim communities in building relationships of trust, hopefully relationships of love, to see if it's possible to build a common good. My experience is that it is possible to do that. But it takes a lot of work, and it's to recognize, and it's a very strange thing for a Jewish person to say, but to recognize that there is a very strong Christian tradition of a common good. There isn't such a strong tradition of that. There's often a desire to dominate within Islam, talking theologically. So it's a big leap to find a concept of a balance, of a diversity of interests. So it's a really demanding political moment in relation to Islam, where we have to simultaneously show an enormous love and an enormous stubbornness in defending liberty, in asserting the integrity of persons and of a toleration.
Can I put it to you, Morris, that the success that you have had with faith leaders, and particularly Muslim leaders, on things like the Living Wage campaign is maybe because you've dealt with some of those more liberal Islamic leaders? Have you been able to penetrate what has been accused of as being the sort of the more inward-looking communities in parts of northern England?
Just to say, in terms of the Living Wage campaign, it was, you know, we worked with the East London Mosque, really hardcore Muslim communities, but what they have is poor congregants. So both in terms of the Living Wage and in terms of anti-usury, they had interests there in the preservation of family life, in respect for work, which is a very important concept in Islam. So, yeah, in that case, that was a real relationship with trusted mosques in the very heartlands of their communities.
That's the British Labour member of the House of Lords, Morris Glassman. He's been in Australia for events with the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, the Whitlam Institute, and the John Cain Foundation.